Howdy friends, this is Matt Sewell, and you're listening to episode 93 of the Popecast, A History of the Papacy, the only podcast about popes where you'll find non-boring stories on the successors of St. Peter and a reminder that all the world's problems have happened plenty of times before. Right quick, before we dive in, if you're a new or long-time listener to the show, we'd love to get these new episodes early, some bonus content on episodes like the one you're about to listen to, and you would also like to support our work, please consider visiting patreon.com/thepopecast. Again, on this episode, there's about 5 to 10 minutes of bonus content just for patrons. Plus, you'll get some neat swag that you can get as well, and you'll be joining an existing community of Popecast superfans. So that's at patreon.com/thepopecast. And then lastly, we have a papal history project in email form that's related but not quite the same as this, called Today in Papal History, which you can sign up for free or be a paid subscriber at popes.substack.com. Thanks, as always, for listening, and now on to the show. Our guest this week is Mr. Timothy Nerozzi. Timothy is currently a reporter over at Fox News Digital, but has written for a large swath of solid publications, including Catholic News Agency, The Lamp Magazine, Washington Examiner, and The Daily Caller. I especially enjoyed this conversation for a ton of reasons. Timothy shares his take on why religion reporting is quite terrible these days, his approach to journalism, and then of course we go into great detail on the office of the papacy itself, nerding out on things like why we should keep a level head about Pope Francis, how the papacy itself has been changing over the past century, and a ton more to boot. So without further ado, here is today's episode. Well, Timothy Nerozzi, thanks for joining the Popecast.
No, thanks for having me on. I'm actually really excited.
Yeah, I was trying to think when the first time it was that I ran across you. And actually, as I was doing a little bit of research, like preparing for this, I realized it was an article that you wrote. What was it called? Fat American Jesus or something like that you wrote late last year, late 2021?
It was, about the Buddha. Right? About, yeah. It was called Go, If Jesus Says No, Go Ask Your Buddha. And it was really like this looking back, a little angry, but I think rightfully angry, screed about about how, you know, so many Americans now are disillusioned with organized religion. And so they think that the thing that they can do is just give up on Christianity and then they could go be Buddhist. And like I say that with air quotes, and what they think that means is that you could do whatever you want and you're always supposed to be accepting of who you are and you should always, and that's not at all what Buddhism is. So that really irked me that day. And it got a lot of attention. Clearly it's the reason I'm here. So I'm glad that I wrote it in retrospect.
Yeah. So I don't think I actually realized, I don't know that I had made the connection, or I had just forgotten the connection, that it was you that wrote it, mm-hmm. but I reread it, and yeah, oh man, it was the perfect balance of, like, angry screed, but, like, it was a righteous angry screed.
I think it was, like, just, you know,
like, put, yes, point, putting the finger on the truth that is, I guess, secular American religion, maybe.
Yeah, just, I'm angry and here's why, is really, that, right. I guess, that genre of writing.
I did love that you put, I don't know, there had to be a half a dozen at least of the inspirational quote graphics, oh, the supposed Buddha quotes that were just all
he is. I'm pretty sure that this is, you know, see, this is bad journalistic practice. I shouldn't be saying this, but I'm pretty sure that Buddha is the most misquoted person in history. Like, just in terms of, I mean, nowadays, any sort of inspirational quote site or whatever will just throw anything that they don't have an author for. It's either Mark Twain or it's Buddha. And so, again, like, Americans don't even know what Buddhism is because they get their Buddhism from Facebook, so.
Right, yeah. How many Americans think Mark Twain and Buddha are the same person?
I know, right?
Probably, yeah. Probably more than we'd like to see. Yeah, well, at any rate, so we're mutual followers followers of each other on Twitter, and I always mm-hmm. appreciate your, not crass, but just, yeah, very kind of blunt takes on things. I appreciate kind of the tweet storms that come later in the evening. Yeah. That are usually just, yeah, very pointed and very good. So, yeah. So, anyways, to the listeners of the podcast, this might seem a little bit random that, a guy that I encountered on Twitter who I appreciate his takes on things is the next guest. But I swear that this will be good. But anyway, so maybe just to kick off, a little bit of a background on yourself, who you are, where you come from, what makes you tick.
So I was born in northeastern Pennsylvania in a tiny, tiny, tiny town called Center Moreland. It's probably about 45 minutes away from Scranton. I grew up there. I grew up in a Catholic family. My parents, you know, took us to church every Sunday. I went through Sunday school, First Holy Communion, everything like that. I was not super religious in high school. And then I went to college and I started studying Japanese and basically marketing slash journalism, like a PR degree, basically. And around that time, I started to get back into the church. I started caring about it again. I started taking it more seriously as not just this kind of ethereal, you know, spirituality, but it's actually a mechanism that moves and changes and has pieces. And so when I actually got out of school, I went and did some teaching in Japan. I lived there for 3 years, but I also got to kickstart my journalism career. And it happened to be the perfect opportunity for me because I was right around the two things that I loved most to write about, which was Japan and the Catholic Church. So I wrote a lot. I wrote for Catholic News Agency a little bit as a stringer when Pope Francis was in Tokyo. I was there with the Catholic News Agency badge. And I did some reporting from outside of Nagasaki. So I came back to America during COVID-19. I wanted to stay longer, but I got this letter from the embassy basically saying, we don't know what is happening in the world right now, because this was only when China and Japan had cases. There was none in America yet. So they're like, we don't know. They're like, dear foreigner, we don't know what's happening right now. So if you have any intention of leaving Japan anytime soon, get out. Get out now. And so I I had to pay all my back rent. I had to quit my job. I had to, you know, grab everything that I could and get back to America. I hid away in a cabin, a fishing cabin that my family has. And I just I started writing more and more there. You know, I was just coming off of being a teacher, so I was writing more and more. I was like, okay, this, you know, I think I can make it in journalism. I think I can get a job in journalism. I got hired by the Daily Caller. I was with the Daily Caller for quite a while, and they absolutely taught me how to cut my teeth and how to report fairly and accurately, and the responsibility of being a journalist. From there, I went to the Washington Examiner. I loved that. I also moved down to D.C. around the time I started with the Caller, and I live there now. But I worked for the Washington Examiner, great place, love that publication, and right now I'm at Fox News Digital. So I'm on the print side, if you want to call it that, the website, stuff like that. And I'm a breaking news reporter, but Fox gives their journalists a lot of freedom in what they get to cover, you know, if it's interesting for their readers and if it's well written, then they typically give you the green light. So I've used my expertise, in addition to being a breaking news reporter, right? Like, as I'm reporting on the president, Congress, different things like that. But, you know, when I have a free minute, I usually get, you know, one article about the Pope a day, or, something about China or something about Taiwan with the East Asia, you know, bent that I have. And, yeah, I mean, I think the wider news media, the secular news media, is really waking up to how important of a story the Pope and the Catholic Church are right now. So I'm trying to approach my job as just for the secular world, for Fox News' readership, which is really not Catholic at all. They do have a vested interest in what the Pope does. They, you know, whether they love him or hate him, they want to know what's going on with the Pope. They wanted to know about the German conference and the Pope's response to them. They wanted to know about the Canadian visit. So yeah, that's really where I put myself now, is that I'm in the secular media and I'm reporting secularly, but I'm trying to use my knowledge as a Catholic to give, you know, everyday readers that see the importance of the church a clear idea of what's going on.
Yeah. That's interesting. Well, I would even say probably not just as a Catholic, but as a Catholic who gives a damn, right? to put it lightly. Yeah. I mean, like, you know, a Catholic, that's not probably not entirely fair, but like a Catholic who actually is done in their homework, you know. Right? And not just like I think there's plenty of reporters who are Catholic who like don't exactly know much below the surface. And again, to no fault of their own, but like you actually have, before you did this, went out and hunted down, you know, good reasons behind the truth, and now
I think that a lot of times religious journalism right now is in such a sticky situation because we're living in a secular world that is really not spiritual, or at least it hasn't been for the last couple of decades. So the idea that you would have someone objectively report on spirituality or faith or religion to secular news bigwigs is usually a little, like, it gets kind of a quizzical look because they just don't think. Again, this isn't everyone, but I think this old guard is moving on now, but for a very long time, up until very recently, they just didn't see that as something that you reported. You know, that was something for the parish newsletter, or that was something for, you know, some Baptist conference or some, you know, synagogue opening. That was their own thing, and the secular society really wasn't keeping up with the politics of it all and the inner workings of it all. So nowadays, a lot of the things that the public knew and took for granted, like how different branches of Christianity work, has kind of been forgotten, and you get a lot of readers that don't quite understand, and a lot of writers that are not conveying that information to their readers. So, again, that's the criticisms that I would have of how journalism has treated religion recently, and that's what I'm trying to fix, I guess.
Right. Yeah, I think that's a good point. And well, I want to say that J.D. Flynn from The Pillar, they've been on the podcast in the past. He kind of said the same thing, where religion journalism it's kind of an oxymoron. Mm-hmm. It's like become mm-hmm. sort of an oxymoron. Like, people just don't know what they're really doing. Much to the point where, like, was it the New York Times, I think? The editor-in-chief? I read something that, like, there was some commentary that I watched where the way that he said something pertaining to religious people betrayed the fact that everybody in the newsroom, like, doesn't know anybody who's religious. Mm-hmm. How much does that play into it, do you think, where they're writing about the Pope or something, but they don't have literally any frame of reference in their own personal life to be able to kind of title?
Yeah, so I think that you're always going to have a gap in knowledge for a journalist. There's no such thing as a journalist that just knows exactly objectively what happened at any... Even guys that were there, or, I'm sorry, women that were there, or anyone that was there that saw something happen, that doesn't even make them the objective arbiter of what happened. So there's always going to be a gap in what you know and what you have to research, what you have to look into, and what you have to draw conclusions from. I think that a lot of people approach reporting on the Pope not with that knowledge gap as being appreciated as there and trying to address it, but instead they're just kind of filling in that gap with what their worldview, right? How they think the world works. And so it just filters all of the news through this, whatever lens that they're putting on it. And they might not know what the reason is that, for example, only men can be priests. And instead of really digging down to the heart of that and trying to find the real core reason why this doesn't get debated inside the Catholic Church, they just kind of write it off as like, oh, it's a tradition since whenever, and so they just don't want to change it. It's like, well, no, I mean, whether you think there should be women priests or not, as anyone that's Catholic or not Catholic, you should know why it is the way that it is now. And I think that goes for all religions, you know? That was kind of the same thing that I was getting at with that essay about Buddhism in America, where it's, you know, if you're going to try and speak about this seriously, you should really try and fill in the gaps and, you know, don't straw man things that you don't understand.
Yeah. What's the, have you heard of the Chesterton wrote about it? Everybody's called it Chesterton's fence for the last 100 or so years.
Yeah, where, yeah.
Yeah, a man walks up to a gate and says, I don't see a point for this, I'm going to tear it down. And I would say, no, you're not able to do that until you can tell me why it's there, and then I might.
Yeah, yeah, right. Like, tear it down. Don't simplify everything down into, oh well, this is here because tradition, and so because you could do that on both pro or against any particular thing, right? But to completely forego looking into the reasons that those things exist now is kind of it's kind of the sign of the quote unquote like deconstruction age of reporting and writing. Everything's a deconstruction, everything's a critical analysis of whatever, and it's usually just dismissal instead of understanding.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, dismissal of each other, yeah, for sure. Well, I was I just thought of John Paul II, of when he went into the conclave. I think that the one that elected him, he brought the Communist Manifesto with him. Have you ever heard about this? So he brought the Communist Manifesto. Yeah, I love the story because, you know, of course he gets all these sideways glances, but he's like, I need to understand. I'm not just going to write them off because they're communists or something, or because communism is bad and somebody told me that. I need to understand it from the on the inside. But yeah, that's a good perspective. So I think more broadly, you wanted to chat about, yeah, the papacy's place in the world. I mean, as far as, you know, not just how the Pope affects the people who he is, you know, objectively spiritual father of, I suppose, but mm-hmm. also like the, what, like the position of the Pope, would you say, in the wider world? So
yeah, feel free. I was speaking before about just the way that a lot of, again, this is mostly online discourse. Online discourse is heightened and kind of a little divorced from real life, but I think that it does usually give you a glimpse of what issues people are talking about. And I see a lot of people approaching Pope Francis in a really just not productive way. You know, I'm not a cheerleader for Pope Francis, and I'm also not a harsh critic of him. He's, you know, he's the Pope, and as a Catholic, I have to respect the Pope, but he has plenty of things I disagree with. But I think that observing what he does, and in the same way, looking into the reason that he's doing things, looking to the reason that he says certain phrases, certain words, the reasons he doesn't address things, instead of understanding and trying to think critically and say, okay, well, what could he be thinking and why would he do this? Both secular, anti-Catholic, hyper-traditional, whatever, all of these people, instead of ascribing, okay, well, this is what he's thinking, it's, oh, no, he hates the church, and so therefore he's banned the traditional Latin Mass. Oh, he is a traditionalist who hates the LGBT community, so that's why he's cracking down on the German council. It's always just, he doesn't like me, or he doesn't like the good thing, or he likes the good thing, and that's why he's doing. You know, it's a very simple, where the, you know, the Pope is a human being, and the Catholic Church is not, again, it's not some ethereal spirituality that we all gather for. It's a very physical brick and mortar system of governance and teaching. So to dumb things down like that, and even to base the entire debate around the Pope only is bizarre to me. It's very simplistic, if that makes sense.
Yeah, no, I largely agree. I don't know what it is about. I mean, I think it's just a natural human thing that when, you know, life has any sort of uncertainty in it, which all of our lives have some form of some degree of uncertainty. But I don't know. You know, people are worried about the world. It's largely why this podcast exists. You know, there's this fear that the world's going to end tomorrow, so I have to come up with this super rigid, simplistic explanation for why, so I can feel comfortable watching the world decline or something. I don't know. And I think it happens all at the level of the subconscious or something, whether it's like, oh, a one world government, something really conspiratorial like that, or my neighbor hates me, or you know, whatever. Like, it's easier for me to think that, you know, something that I can't actually tangibly prove than it is for me to admit that life is messy and there aren't clean answers to things, but that, you know, largely everybody's in the same boat and we're all seasick. As who said that? That was Chesterton, I think. Again, I don't know.
I actually love, I think one of the main things that got me into your show was your tagline at the beginning, and I could butcher it, but it's just to show that all of the problems that we have now have been around since the beginning of the church or whatever.
Something,
That is such a great tag, because it's so true, and that's really what the value that I find in your show is the fact that it shows me, it reminds me of all these things that the media and, you know, different political factions inside the church and anti-Catholic sections of society, all of these things that these groups are trying to turn into major life or death scenarios that you have to be on a side and you have to look at it very basically. It's like, no. We once had a corpse put on trial by a pope. So, like, this isn't, you know, it kind of, it reminds me of, there was a comedian that just recently made a joke where he says, it's Shane Gillis, the comedian, and he said something like, people say now that we're more divided as a country than ever. He's like, you know, we had a civil war. You know that we fought each other over that. And it's kind of the same concept, right? It's like, this is the darkest time in the church. We have a heretic on the throne. It's like, you know, there were orgies in the Vatican, right? Like, we know that there were orgies in the Vatican. So, like, don't tell me that this is the special one. It makes me laugh.
You know that there was I say that all the time when people say, oh, Pope Francis is the worst. Like, you know, he actually doesn't crack the top 50 for sure, yeah. Like the top 30. And I don't even consider him a bad pope. Yeah. I consider him like among the top 100 of probably the best ones we've had.
Even if you were a total raging anti-Francis person, you can't in clear conscience tell me that he's even in your top 50 worst popes of all time.
No.
I think anyone trying to even claim that is kind of losing the plot.
He doesn't have any children. An army hasn't stormed the Lateran Palace and thrown him bodily from the city twice. You know,
I don't know why. And you see, again, working in the secular world, and not that Catholic journalism and secular journalism are particularly different. They both have pretty rigorous standards. But I guess with Catholic journalism, you kind of assume that the reader has basic understandings of certain concepts. And to break all those down for a wider audience that doesn't have a lot of exposure to Catholicism, that can be challenging. And I was very frustrated about the reporting on the big scandal, that they had to try and make some scandal out of this Canadian visit. So they tried to make it a big deal about him wearing the headdress or something.
Right.
Someone called it like heretical or whatever. And it's just one of those things where it's like, you know, that the reason we even call him the pontiff is we stole that. We stole that from the pagans. So this idea that the Pope is some sort of like bubble boy that can't touch the outside world, right? It's not like he's, you know, you had people reporting it as either, look at this fantastic gesture of ecumenicalism, you know, Pope Francis donning the ceremonial headdress of blah, 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 blah. Or you had the trad reaction, which was, this is apostasy. He is praying to nature spirits. It's just not, that's not how the world works. That's not, I don't know. It's superimposing certain positions, certain motivations to him because they don't see, not just Pope Francis, but any pope, they don't see them so much as a ruler. They see them as a kind of like a puppet or like a, kind of like the flag in the center of a tug of war. And so you just have to, move your piece. You need to be in control of the pontiff, right? You need to be in control of where the church is going. And they don't appreciate the fact that Francis is their ruler, and they actually, this isn't a democracy, and they don't get to you know, try and impeach him because he wore a headdress.
Yeah. No, I agree. I don't, there's lots of thoughts on that. One, I think it's interesting, like you did say, you know, online life, the people who are, it happens on every social network, I think. But like, that's kind of where the Twitter opinions or the people who have gained their popularity in the Catholic world and not online, like their influence and their ideas seep over into real life to where, you know, you have churches full of people who listen to, you know, Taylor Marshall or you know, I don't know, voting blocks full of people who listen to Alex Jones. I don't know, like all these, you know, conspiratorial wackos where is like we can say, oh yeah, that guy just lives online and he doesn't affect real life or something. But then, you know, oh, there's, you know, 150,000 or a million people who follow, you know, such and such a person, then like those people are somewhere and they're, you know, interacting with other people. And I mean, that type of thing. So, I mean, what do you think is the, in terms of like, again, back to your role and what you're trying to do with your knowledge of Catholicism and it's in your position, it's a secular journalist, but like, what do you think is the way to kind of make baby steps there where people don't have exposure to, you know, the inner working, like the intricacies of who the Pope actually is, and just have preconceived notions about either the Pope or the church, or they, you know, had a bad experience once, or their, you know, dad was abusive and they grew up in the church. I mean, you know, like any number of these types of hypotheticals. What do you think is the most helpful way to start?
Okay. This could get very rambly, so cut me off if I start going way off track here, but. I think
it's fine. Long form.
One way to think about this is that the dynamic is supposed to be in the church a hierarchy going down and then coming back up. So you're having teaching coming from the down from the top down, and you're supposed to have response and, you know, criticism and encouragement coming from the bottom. You know, this is what we like. This is the type of sermon that we like to hear. You know, this church is very popular, so we're doing this, right? So that's what you're supposed to have. And I think that somewhere along the line, far before I was born and far before you were born, I think that started to switch a little bit. And it started to become listening from the top down and this democratic idea coming from the bottom up. And I don't think we've... I think it's starting to change again, and I think Pope Francis is actually the one that's doing that, but it's going to be very messy, and it causes a lot of people to try and attack and try and make claims about whatever part of the church is relevant to maintain that voice, right? So a good example of this is very, very hardcore Catholics that kind of subscribe to this, I don't even know how to pronounce it, the term for when the Pope, ultra something, when the Pope is hyper Montanist.
Ultra-Montanist,
when you subscribe to this worldview, it's typically because you see something in it that you want that aspect of it, or this thing that happens through it, to have more power and more say in society. And so a lot of people subscribe to this because they see the Pope as the way to enact that change and use that political power onto society. What they don't realize is that the Pope is a ruler and a teacher. Whether you approve of him or not, he's going to do whatever he wants to do. And this isn't a democratic institution. And ironically, some of the most anti-democratic people in the Catholic Church, right? Like I'm not sure how democratic integralism is, but you know, like the monarchists, right? There are monarchists nowadays that are running around saying, like, yeah, that's what I believe is. Like, look, I'm not gonna bash anyone that likes monarchy, but if you're gonna be that way, then you need to walk the walk, right? You need to listen when your ruler and teacher speaks. And I think that that's the dynamic that is currently being fought in the church, both on both sides, the trads and, you know, the German conference, or the very, very, very liberal Catholics, that they've kind of walked away from the idea of listening to the Vatican. And, you know, there's plenty of reasons for that. There's the sex abuse scandal. There's been a lot of, you know, very messy internal politics. There's been a lot of embarrassing things happening in the church. And so a lot of people just stopped listening. And I think that what Pope Francis right now is concerned with is making sure that people are listening, right? And that's where you get the correction letter written to the German council. That's where you get this is very touchy, but that's where you get all the crackdowns on the traditional Latin Mass. I don't pretend like I know the secret knowledge of what the Pope wants and what the Pope does and what he thinks and what's true. But what I do know is, like, I can observe as someone that really kind of tries to stay away from influencing the church, but more so just keeping everyone informed on it. But that's the case, is that it seems that Pope Francis, for better or for worse, is trying to remind the world that he's a teacher and a leader. He's not just like a mascot or a figurehead.
Right. Yeah, that's a really good point. I'm glad you brought that up, because I agree. And we're also it also just like takes taking a breath and realizing that really for the first time in the history of, well, for the first time since the very beginning of the papacy, which Catholicism believes started when the Roman Empire still outlawed Christianity, for the first three centuries, like, the church did not have any political power. And I mean, sure, now, you know, the church is a large voting bloc. Like, Catholics make up a large voting bloc in America and elsewhere. There's a billion of us, but, you know, practically speaking, the Pope is a ruler. I mean, he's the sovereign of Vatican City, but no longer, for the first time really in, like, what, 1600 years, as of about 100 years ago, the Pope didn't really have any political sway, like, wasn't a world leader in the sense that he's like a king in addition to a spiritual head. So pretty much now, I think that's why there's, you know, been some, you know, confusion here or there, or some parsing out of the Pope's new role after the Papal States went away, like all that type of stuff, which I think is good. But I think, yeah, for Pope Francis, why I really appreciate him, I'm kind of in the same boat. I'm not a hater of him, for sure. I largely love how he teaches, even though it's very challenging for me in some ways. That he's saying, yeah, guys, it's a third way. You know, I think it's safe to say that the German conference, he's saying, you guys are making this about yourselves and about the world and not about what's eternal. And I think, again, it's a more sensitive thing. But with the Latin Mass, I think the tendency has been, like, it's become almost like a fundamentalist, where it's like a worship of the thing instead of a worship of Jesus Christ, which is what the Pope's trying to remind people. It's like saying, you know, guys, this isn't actually moving the church as a whole forward, even though it's an objectively good thing. And even though probably he would say, yeah, it's beautiful, great. But the fruit of it is just becoming poisonous mm-hmm. on both sides.
Yeah, you see this, like you said, like yeah. on both sides. And this isn't some sort of like, oh, middle of the road, like I'm so moderate. Both sides are actually that. It's like, no. It's not even sides. It's different factions and demographics that are all vying for power through the papacy. You see a large proliferation of, you know, kind of, I would call it like adjective-Catholic. Whether that is, you know, Polish Catholic, Black Catholic, you know, you get some really sketchy shit when you get some really sketchy stuff. You get some really sketchy stuff when you get into like the very far right Catholics that are, you know, starting to flirt with like really, really wild things about race, and they're basically like getting out their phrenology kits, and it's like this is not what the church is supposed to be, and that's why these demographics warring like this is so frustrating for everyone, whether it's from the top down or from the bottom up. There isn't that linchpin anymore, and the linchpin is supposed to be the hierarchy, and that failed pretty spectacularly for the past couple of, you know, centuries. You know, the hierarchy kind of fell apart multiple times, and so now everyone is vying for meaning and where to go. And I think Pope Francis is trying to be, for better or for worse, again, if you think that the Pope should just keep his mouth shut, no matter who he is, and just, you know, because there are some people, and I'm sympathetic to the view that the Pope is way too prominent nowadays. He's constantly, I mean, as someone in the media, he's constantly under a microscope, right? And that will always be the case for as long as people pay attention to him. And if they pay attention to him, then he's going to get more famous. So for better or for worse, right now we're entering a very Pope-centric age of the church for the foreseeable future. And yeah, it's kind of scary because you don't know how this is going to go. Because this is kind of the equivalent of around the Reformation, where the discussion of the politics of the church and the again critical analysis, whatever you want to call it, has been democratized, and now it's time for everyone to come together and try and figure out what the church even is nowadays.
Yeah, it's interesting because I just read a poll. last week was it from Gallup or something that showed that only 15 or 20% of American Catholics consider the Bible mm-hmm. to be the inerrant mm-hmm. word of God or something like that. It's like, it's almost like we're back in like an Arian time mm-hmm. where like 2/3 of the world's bishops didn't believe mm-hmm. a fundamental dogma of mm-hmm. the faith. So like to where you have a large swath of Catholics who mm-hmm. functionally are like don't believe something mm-hmm. that's really fundamental to what it means to be Christian, not even Catholic.
Absolutely, and I think that there's a lot of people that are not necessarily that topic, but I think there's a lot of criticisms that we might have of a lot of Catholics, whether it's not going to church often enough, or more specifically, it's not knowing doctrine properly. And I understand that is totally an issue, but I also don't see it as this malicious turning away from God. I think that a lot of those people that fall right. into that category they were raised in a time, and I'm just talking about like my parents and grandparents at this point, and like my entire extended family that's of a certain generation. They didn't grow up with the sex abuse scandal. They didn't grow up with, you know, jokes about the Catholic Church. It was a very revered institution, and it was at least respected outside of, you know, outside of the churches, it was at least respected and not a laughingstock. And so they didn't have to dig deep to keep the faith, because it was what they did. You know, you go to church every week with your family, and you say the prayers, you get all the sacraments done, and you never really had to learn to defend yourself. Whereas now, the sons and daughters of that generation, my generation, we grew up in a very anti-Catholic world. You know, growing up, the most popular thing to hear about the Catholic Church was how much they sexually abused children. Growing up, you know, South Park had entire episodes about how the Vatican was like this spider web of child molesters, and it was like played for laughs. So when we became more serious about religion, we had to learn the hard facts, and we had to learn the justifications. And so I think that is why there are so many, there's a rising number of people that think very critically about the church in a good way, in a serious way, and in a positive way. And I think that's what we've got to be hoping for, because that is what will get those numbers up. The people that say that the Bible isn't inerrant, or the people that don't understand transubstantiation, these basic doctrines, now that we're out of that, we're officially past the residual goodwill of all those years, right? And now we're, you know, we're being attacked in the media, right? Knights of Columbus was called like a radical organization during the Supreme Court hearings. So, I'm sorry, during the Supreme Court confirmations. So yeah, I think if you want those numbers up, it's time to make, again, this is what Pope Francis, I think, is trying to do. He's trying to whip everyone together and be like, all right, if you want to be taken more seriously, it's time to rally around something. And in the age of an ultra exposed Pope, it's going to be the Pope.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I find that fascinating. Like the shadow side of that, yeah, all of that is well and good. I agree. Mm-hmm. The shadow side that I find really interesting in light of like historical popes who were, I think, personally, who were personally holy men. I'm thinking of like Pope Benedict XIII is the one that initially comes to mind. Most haven't heard of him. You may or may not have, but the episode was the Pope who has resting bitch face was the name of the episode that I did on him, because he just looks really crabby.
Yeah.
But he's a super holy guy, but he was not a good administrator. Mm-hmm. Like fundamentally, he was known as, frankly, a terrible administrator, like a boss. Mm-hmm. Like he's not a good boss. He's a great spiritual father, like a good, like a very virtuous holy man. And I think, unfortunately, that's kind of what seems to get Pope Francis in a bit of hot water, is that, and I think what, you know, maybe John Paul to a certain degree, Benedict, just because those weren't any of the three of their gifts. And so a lot of the, you know, actual bad things that have happened under their watch have been as a result of that, which, you know, the Lord's the only one who's going to know whether they're culpable for that or not. I tend to think that, you know, the Vatican is a, there's so many holes in that Swiss cheese that, you know, one man can't possibly know everything that's going on. But yeah, what are your thoughts on that? And as far as like the spiritual component of Francis's pontificate versus, you know, I think what are probably legitimate criticisms of some of his administrative stuff or administrative talent.
Yeah, of course. And again, this could become, I realize that most of the answers I've given have rambled way past whatever you're asking and have gone off track. So,
hey, that's good. No, this is fine.
Okay, so.
Nothing beyond the pale, too, so far.
Pope Francis wearing both hats, right? Well, you know, both metaphorically and literally, he does wear a lot of, the Pope wears a lot of hats. He is, that was on the fly, too. I didn't rehearse that.
That's good.
The Pope is, you know, obviously the Bishop of Rome, first and foremost. That is his actual, that's like, at the end of the day, that's who he is. He's the Bishop of Rome. After that, he's also a king. He's a literal absolute monarch. He rules over Vatican City kind of as a token, right? Like you said, that we don't really have a serious country anymore that's administrated directly by the Pope. But it's a symbolic and important part, which is that he is an absolute authority. He is a sovereign, right? In the same way that Queen Elizabeth is. He doesn't need a passport. He doesn't, you know, he is the country. And then he's also the teacher. And he's also, you know, a fount of honor. And he's wearing all these different hats. So like you said, someone could be really good at one of these things and very terrible at another. I think it's easier maybe to compare Pope Francis and Pope Benedict. Because Pope Francis, I think it's really hard to argue Pope Francis isn't a much better kind of actor in terms of and I don't mean that as in he's disingenuous, but the acts that he does. So he does the apostolic journey to Canada to have this conversation with, you know, communities that were really hurt and still have a bad taste in their mouth about Catholicism. Even though they are a Catholic community, they have a bad taste in their mouth, and it was his mission to go and make that gesture. You see him speak, you see Pope Francis speak, and the communication isn't great. Like the articulation, the really digging down to the real central spec is a little difficult. He talks in broad terms, but the things that he's trying to bring attention to and the acts that he does to get that attention, going to nursing homes, right? Those are when I was in Japan, I was really like missing home. I was watching a bunch of Catholic videos on YouTube, and I saw one of Pope Francis going to this Italian nursing home unexpectedly, and all of these women, like old ladies, like falling down and crying that he came to visit them. And I'm like, that's a good Pope. That is a good Pope. He's doing good things. I think that where he gets in a lot of hot water, and there's a lot of very genuine criticism, is that he just doesn't communicate ideas effectively. He doesn't, whereas Pope Benedict, I mean, I have all sorts of books on my bookshelf from Benedict, and anyone that's read him or listened to him can attest, I'm sure you can too, he's very articulate, written or spoken, he gets the message across very poignantly. But he's also, number one, you know, a little scary looking. Like, he even like when he was younger, when he was Pope, he kind of looked scary. He looked like a mean old man. And he didn't make the best gestures, like acts of a Pope or as, of a spiritual leader, right? I love pomp and circumstance. I love the papal tiara and the shoes of the fisherman, the ring of the fisherman. I love all of the trappings, but he didn't pair those beautiful things. Well, he didn't use the papal tiara, obviously, but he had the red. He was famous for his red shoes. He was called right. The Pope of Aesthetics. He wore the, what's it called, the little Santa hat looking thing. It's got like a red brim.
The papal beanie. Escaping me. Yeah,
something with a C, I think. But yeah, he really embodied that kingness. He embodied that authority, and that's why people still flock to him today, even though he's a Pope Emeritus and wants them to leave him alone. Like, they really appreciated that about him. And it's a shame, but you're never really going to get all of those things in one person. You're never going to get the perfect... Well, and maybe you do, but then they become like a doctor of the church. Like, you get, you know, like Gregory or something. So you can't count on the Pope often at all being a great orator and a great actor and a great king and a great teacher. It's just so many hats to wear that it's very rare that you're going to get someone that that can fulfill all that effectively.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree. I mean, that's why I've whenever people ask, like, what's the deal with Pope Francis over the years, you know, because they know that I'm a nerd for this type of stuff, and they're like, man, did Pope Francis really say this, that, or the other thing? I'll be like, well, if you read what he actually said,
yeah,
he didn't. I mean, like, some stuff where you're just like, oh man, you're like, favors. Yes.
You know, did he say more this? Clearly?
Yeah.
Yeah. Did he say this? No. Was there a reason to be confused? Yeah, there was.
Yes.
There was not super clear what he was trying to say. And you know, again, as a reporter, I'm not. It's not my job to clear up what Pope Francis is saying if he just doesn't give me the pieces. If he says something that people are blowing up about, I can't believe he did this, and he gave his reasoning, or he did something that I could present and be like, well, no, he did it for this. Then, you know, if he doesn't do that, then I can't do anything. And I want to be fair to the Pope, but sometimes, you know, he just does things that he doesn't explain. You know, I think if the trads ever got one thing right, it was the criticism, and I'm not sure how controversial of a stance this is, but I think that they were right to criticize the Pachamama incident, where he had the statue in the Vatican. You know, that seems like a position where he just got that wrong. You know, the church tried to say, oh, well, this is actually a representation of the Virgin Mary in this traditional style, but then it, you know, the maker himself or herself said, like, no, that's, you know, this Mother Earth deity. And so it's rough, because when he makes those mistakes, it justifies thinking that everything else that he said was intentionally anti-dogma or intentionally, you know, heretical, if you're inclined to want to believe that. And in the same way, you know, when he tries to be particularly rough, like, all right, let's get into the TLM thing, right? Because that's all the talk right now, especially in D.C. I'm not going to say my opinion on him banning it, but I do think that it's very clear that the message that he's trying to send is the TLM has become idolatrized by certain segments of the Catholic Church, and that this is unhealthy and it needs to stop. And whether you think he's way putting too heavy of a hand down, or whether you think that it's justified, that's what he's trying to do. And I think that it's a shift into, you talked before about how we don't have a country, we have Vatican City, but we don't have a functioning country. I think that what we're going to see, and this, I'm an idiot, so don't believe what I'm saying, but my armchair opinion is that we're going to see in our lifetimes the Pope shift from, or complete the shift from kind of like an earthly, and I don't want any negative connotation to this, but kind of like an earthly, like politically involved sovereign. And I think he's going to become, or maybe a geographic, best way to put it, he's going to be transitioning from being a geographic sovereign to being a popular sovereign, like the king of the Belgians, or the king of the Franks, or the king of the French, where, you know, it's more emphasized that he is a leader, not of some organized, he's not a leader of an organized territory, he's a leader of the people. And if to be Catholic will be to recognize that, like, yeah, that's my king, that's my pope. I think that that's where we're going. And I'm not sure if Pope Francis is going to get it there, but that's, I think, what he's trying to do.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
Yeah. Yeah, it definitely does. I don't know what that's going to look like, because it's, you know, history kind of bears these things out over 100 or 200 years, and we're still, historically speaking, pretty close to this all changing still. I mean, it's barely 100 years ago, right? Was it... Sorry, oh gosh, I only know papal history really well, but was it Mussolini who basically like annexed the papal states onto the Italy and was like, that's, we're done.
Now, we're still like the Pope figuring this out. Yeah.
Right.
This is a very new, people love, and again, this goes back to the theme of your podcast, right? That there's been, these issues have been around forever, but that there's like, new issues arise, but you can always look backwards and see the same problems. So, you know, we do have a new arising, not, I don't know if it's a problem or not, but it's a development, which is that, hey, the sovereign geographic kind of notion of the Pope, the secular power, is gone. It's pretty much gone. He doesn't have an army. He doesn't have, he does appear at the UN, and he does appear at the, what am I thinking of? The papacy appears all over the world in these certain positions, but it's never, if you look, it's not the Vatican City that appears. The Holy See is the one that has the representation at the UN. And so he's becoming, for better or for worse, whether you like it or not, he's becoming a popular monarch. And he's really soon, I think, in a meaningful way, being Catholic will have to be associated with kind of really acknowledging the legitimacy of Pope Francis's papacy, the legitimacy of all of church history, right? Like, no more revisionism, no more what if Benedict is secretly the Pope, or one time I saw like a Taylor Marshall video where he's like, okay, well, what if Pope Francis is the Pope, but Benedict is still the Bishop of Rome? What does that mean? And it's like, no, we're done. That's not happening anymore. You know, it's, I think that now being Catholic, moving forward, is going to be, whatever your opinions are, you could think that anyone is a terrible leader. You could think any Pope sucks. And that's your right, and you know, you don't have to listen to every single word that he says off the cuff. But I think that soon, that ultramontanist, did I say that right? Ultramontanist,
yeah. Ultramontane being over the mountains. I think it was a dig at Pius the Ninth by somebody.
Damn, that rules. That's a great word.
It's escaping me. Yeah, ultramontane. And so ultramontanist has meant like an overemphasis on what the Pope thinks. And
So I think
over obsession about the Pope. Yeah.
People speculate a lot, and I'm not sure if you've talked about it yet, but speculate a lot about what's going to happen when Pope Francis isn't Pope anymore. God forbid he dies. You know, long live the Pope. I love Pope Francis. You know, I don't want my Pope to die, but he's going to die. And if he doesn't die while he's in the papacy, then he's going to retire, which I don't think he's going to do. But you know, he's not going to be Pope that much longer. So the question is, what is going to happen to the church after this? And I think, I don't know, I'm not a cardinal. I'm nowhere near qualified to be a cardinal, and I hope they never ask for my...
You're technically eligible to be elected as a single...
This is a bit of an embarrassing confession, but I used to have the dream, not actually, but I often used to fantasize about being a lay cardinal like they used to have, like the just really important lazy lay guy that rolls in, usually like his dad is a king somewhere, so you got to just be a cardinal. I wish I had that job. That'd be so cool, walking around those crimson robes, big ring, just being like, yeah, it's me. I didn't have to take any vows. I'm just here with my wife. No. I hope that the cardinals aren't taking my advice on anything, but if I had to give any advice to anyone, it would be, you got to look at whatever candidate is going to be a solid, really universally approved of leader. It doesn't have to be necessarily he doesn't have to be popular in every way, but he has to be a leader that everyone is forced to respect the office. If not the person, that's really what's at play, what role is the papacy gonna play moving forward, and by cascading ramifications, what role will the church have? If you want to be politically powerful, then you need to be centered around something, and in the modern day, when, you know, I think it's a shame, but bishops really don't write that many pastoral letters, they don't really rule over their diocese the way they're supposed to. They're supposed to act almost like a prince or a, I know like a cardinal's literally a prince, but they're supposed to act as rulers. They're supposed to, you know, the secular world rules over that aspect of that geographic location, but the bishop is the ruler spiritually of that entire group. But that's not happening anymore, at least in the United States. Okay. And so, and I know like it's arguably the same in Ireland and the UK and other places where I've talked to people about this, but I think moving forward, it's time to either make that a reality and really quick, or pick a pope that's going to be a uniting leader more than a firebrand for any particular tradition, right? Or any particular reform.
Yeah, that's interesting. Because when I think about Pope Francis, I mean, he kind of was that when he first got elected. I remember, you know, Matt Maher, the musician. He did a video about playing Lord I Need You, a super popular song, for Pope Francis during adoration at World Youth Day in Rio, like right after he got elected. And I remember him like saying, he's like, my human thought was, I don't want to screw up the Pope's prayer time because he's kind of batting 1,000 right now. Like, he got elected. It was like, please pray for me. And we're like, whoa, that's so cool. And he picked Francis. Nobody's ever picked that name before. And then, like, you know, he embraced the guy who had all the boils on his head. Like, all these things. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, as the years went on, he kind of became this galvanizer. And I have a semi-hot take. I know that these two I know that these two men are very different. Very different. Hear me loud and clear. Very different. Mm-hmm. But I think Pope Francis and Donald Trump have had very similar effects on the people in, like, in their respective constituencies. Mm-hmm. In that, you can't, like, you really can't be middle of, like, you can't be middle of the road. Like, it, they galvanized the, I don't know, sensible thing. They separated, like, the wheat from the chaff in a certain sense. Like Pope Francis and Donald Trump have broken people's brains in certain subsets, to the point where, like, this just kind of bubbled up, I don't know, insecurity about, like, they were found to be worshiping not the thing, like the people who ended up hating Pope Francis usually did so because they were, it seems like they were worshiping the church, or they were worshiping or some themselves, or whatever the case might be,
they were requiring the outward expression of reassurance, right? Of like, we're in power, we're secure, because Pope Francis and Benedict a little bit before and since have been pretty clear about, like, no, the church is in bad shape. Like, we are shrinking. We are slipping. And, you know, if you're a Catholic, then you believe the church will maintain in some degree. But I think Benedict wrote that before the church can get bigger, it's going to have to get a lot smaller and a lot more strong.
When Benedict was a priest, that's a much better way to say it. That is, like, people couldn't hide behind their comforts as easily anymore, I don't think, because it was like, there was with Donald Trump, there was the assumption that, like, the Democrats were never going to lose another election or whatever it was, and then he won. Like, wait a second, everything we believed is not true, or we missed something, or it can't be the case. Like, with Pope Francis, he said, maybe, you know, like, just a really reverent mass doesn't mean you're a great Catholic or a virtuous person or whatever, right? Like, there's a million of those types of things, which, like, it's been challenged. There's been things that he said that have been really challenging for me personally, and I know I haven't, like, handled all those things exactly perfectly, but, like, I've considered it a bit of a grace to be able to see, oh man, okay, he was the guy that we needed in the papacy right now, after John Paul and Benedict, who were very precise in their own respective ways in what they wrote. But Pope Francis is, like, showing people a different way of being Christian, period. Not even just being Catholic, I don't think.
If you want to criticize Pope Francis for being a poor communicator, I think that's totally rational. I think if you want to criticize his theology, I think he's been pretty unclear on a lot of things, and, you know, I think that's fine to criticize him for. But as a leader, right, in terms of just, like, you're in charge of maintaining, you know, you're the captain of the ship.
As a steward of the job that he has.
Maybe, as a steward, I think as the servant of the servants of God, if you want to put it that way, I think he's done incredible things in a secular way in terms of building up the cachet and the power of the Catholic Church politically. I mean, Elon Musk went out of his way to meet with Pope Francis. I mean, that's an that's the richest man on earth, went out of his way to have a conversation with the Pope in the Pope's palace. I believe he dressed for the part, like he dressed the way you're supposed to, like reverentially. And, you know, both him and the Pope came away from it being like, yeah, no, that was a very productive talk. And I just, I think that you would not have really gotten that. I don't know. He embodies this sense. He's a larger than life personality. You're right. The comparison with Donald Trump is very good because he just kind of talks off the cuff like Donald Trump does. He just sort of like, he's just having a conversation, and sometimes he might say something kind of stupid and everyone like jumps on it. But overall, I mean, look at what Catholicism has recovered just since Pope Francis has been in the papacy. You went from, like I said, when I was a kid, you know, it was constantly the butt of everyone's joke, the Catholic Church. You were, you know, it was a bunch of sex abusers, it was a bunch of, you know, closeted homosexual, like, deviants and weirdos that believe in the sky daddy, blah, 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 blah. And now you look at, I mean, look at how much power the Catholic Church is wielding, for better or for worse, depending on what you think the Church's role is. You know, the Catholic Church holds the majority of these Supreme Court justice positions, or not the majority, but they got this really strong grip on the Supreme Court. You have a Catholic president, you have, I mean, a professing Catholic president, you have some major, like, some of the biggest pieces of art that have come out. Like, I think back to Silence, I think back to, like, Martin Scorsese's Silence, I think back to Martin Scorsese's The Irishman, too, also paints Catholicism this very, like, interesting light. It's become a philosophy that's, I don't want to say cool, because it's kind of flippant, but Catholicism and the Catholic Church's role in society has been strengthened under Pope Francis, because he has been such a aggressive leader, cracking the whip, making those appearances, being the servant to the servants, making these trips to Canada. He's in the news. And so that makes people engage with Catholicism. And I think people would be surprised at how not liberal most people think Pope Francis is. You know,
well, even like trads, he's a confounding enough presence for people. Mm-hmm. I mean, you and I are very familiar with, like, the pet peeves that, like, people on Catholic Twitter have with Pope Francis. But I think outside of the realm of, like you said earlier, people who just don't really know enough at all about Catholicism and they've never really encountered it, he's like this kind of confounding presence to see, oh, here's this guy, and I, like, maybe I've heard that, you know, Catholicism is really oppressive towards women, or really oppressive towards indigenous people, or molested a bunch of kids, or still is, maybe, I don't really know, you know, like, people have have these priors. But then they see, oh, the guy who's the leader of all the Catholics going and apologizing for genocide is what, like, the actual word that he used.
Washing refugees' feet, right. Which I know that so many people, again, these people that worship the church, right, they worship this wielding of power and saying, like, no, you know, we have this supreme dignity. Kind of like it's kind of a pride thing, that they don't like to see those acts of charity or that softness of his leadership, because they think, oh, well, if he's being soft, that means that he doesn't actually believe in anything, and that means that he's actually, you know, selling out doctrine. When instead, a perfect example of this is his remarks on, like, homosexuality or transgenderism. He is the Pope of Mercy, right? Like, that is basically his entire philosophy governing, is he's merciful. Not tolerant, he's merciful. So one of the first things that happens is he gets a microphone in front of his face and they say, what do you think about gay marriage in the Catholic Church? Or what do you think of gay people? And so he says, you know, if, very specifically, I think I could quote this pretty accurately, he said something like, if they are a good person and they are seeking Christ, who am I to you know, take issue with them? Who am I to, like... And what he's clearly saying is that, like, if this person is making a good faith effort to live a good life and is, quote-unquote, seeking Jesus, then who am I to judge him? Who am I to, like, cast aspersions? Right? That's not a radical position at all.
No. He speaks about, like, an individual case, too. Like, there was it was a long time ago. It was, I don't know, 7 or 8 years ago now, maybe, where he made the, he used some form of, like, the mating like rabbits, or having children like rabbits or something. You remember that. Mm-hmm. And they were like, oh my gosh, he's against large families. Like, no, he's against, he was speaking to the case of a mom who had, like, who was a single mom or was sick or was in danger of dying, having another child or something, and saying, like, that's not just what we're supposed, you know, speaking to a specific case. But it seems like I've always kind of fallen back on that too, where, yeah, the media or, you know, people who have an axe to grind or whatever the case might be, always expand it to mean a whole group, when usually, like, he's just a pastor who's speaking usually to a specific case, and probably, to his credit, forgets that he's the Pope and is, like, it's going to be construed and applied to a group or something like that. But yeah, but still, like, it, you know, it shows the heart of him, I think. And again, you know, his flaws, but I think you're right. He's the Pope of Mercy. And, like, if at the end of the day, when Pope Francis dies, again, long live the Pope. Hopefully it's not for a long time. If that's the thing that he's remembered for, is that he asked us all, like, he tried to get us to all be a little bit more merciful toward our neighbor, then, he'd be rising up the list of best popes. And I would say, you know, for all the wrongs that he's done, for all the legitimate criticism people have, like, I think that's a pretty darn good...
I think a good follow-up to that would be to touch on his relationship with other leaders around the world, right? So people get really on him about Nancy Pelosi and Joe Biden being, you know, self-professing Catholics. And I don't have a hot take on this. I don't have this is what should be happening. But I think that people don't appreciate the conundrum that he is in, which is that he has the leader of the free world, arguably the most actual raw power position in the world, is by name a Catholic, right? And the one of his subordinates that is also incredibly powerful in the most militarily powerful country in the world is also a Catholic. So what do you do when these people are very openly committing, you know, really, really terrible statements and are supporting, like, really clearly anti-Catholic positions like abortion? A lot of tribes would tell you, well, that is the Pope's jurisdiction to tell that president, you cannot take communion, you are hereby excommunicated. That might be the correct move. I'm not here to say whether it is or not, but I think they don't understand that also the Pope is the leader for the Catholic Church. He's the mascot. He's the figurehead. He is the one that is really on the international stage. So I think that he has machinations and plans and thoughts about the president, President Biden specifically, that just we're not aware of, and he doesn't care to inform us. I think that when he met with them, you know, the only thing that we heard about it was that Joe Biden said that Pope Francis told me he was a great Catholic and to keep doing what he's doing, and the Pope loves him. And it's like, the Pope didn't say anything. And now you could say, well, the Pope should have corrected him and said, actually, I like chewed you out. But then you get into, okay, well, what happened in that room? What happens between Nancy Pelosi and the Pope? What happens between Joe Biden and the Pope? There is the argument, and I don't want to commit to this, but a consideration is, look, it's pretty well documented at this point that Biden's mental health is not fantastic, and there might be something happening with Joe Biden and the Pope where the Pope might be, he doesn't feel comfortable excommunicating the leader of the free world who he thinks is not acting particularly, like, in full capacity, you know, because that has ramifications. Excommunicating the United States' president has huge cascading ramifications. So what happens when they say, well, should he be excommunicated? Why is he taking communion when he believes in abortion? He very clearly states, you should tell Joe Biden to examine his conscience and talk to his bishop or minister about this incoherence. He used the term incoherence. So he's being very open and saying, no, like, he is clearly not correct. This is not something that should be happening. But he's also saying, go and talk to the bishop. Go and talk to the minister. You're like, why do I, the Pope, have to step in here and enforce this for another country? The USCCB is totally capable of excommunicating the president if they want to. Maybe they have the same concerns. You know, this isn't new. There's been political ramifications to Catholic politics since, who was the king that got excommunicated? He had to come back in a bag and sock pocket.
Henry IV, one of my favorite instances. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Gregory VII.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Made him kneel in
so,
the snow.
Like, yep. Yeah, this sort of thing is not new. The spiritual reality of whether or not Joe Biden is a Catholic in good standing is something that could be outwardly stated by the Pope, but it's also something you could just, you know, think about and consider. And I'm not trying to put this one way or another. I'm just saying, you know, the Pope doesn't have to rule on every single issue in every single country that has any relationship to the Church.
Right.
He could, but he doesn't have to.
Right. And, you know, at the end of the day, it could just be, in the words of Dwight Schrute, Beeswax Not Yours Incorporated. You know, so we've been going for almost an hour. I don't know how that is possible. I feel like I looked at the clock and it was like 11 minutes, and then I looked at the clock and it was like an hour. So we'll end the non-patron portion of this interview here. But if you would like to become a patron and get the last part of this interview, patreon.com/thepopecast is where you can find this. So head on over there, and then we'll have a little bit of music for a transition. Okay, now, for all of you fine patrons and subscribers of the Today in Papal History newsletter, we always like to save this question for our guests at the very end. So. Oh, well, this has been great. So hopefully this is not the last time.
Yeah.
I know it's the first time you're being on the show. Hopefully not the last time, but...
no, please.
Thanks again for being on. I'll... yeah.
Thank you.
Is there any like pet project or something you'd like to promote to help people find you?
Yeah, so you can... I'm a breaking news reporter for Fox News Digital, so you can find me on there by searching my name or just going to, you know, readfoxnews.com. You can also find me on Twitter. I'm at Timothy Nerozzi. Timothy and then N as in November, E-R-O-Z-Z-I. I would say if you're looking for someone to just give you like hard facts constantly, I'm probably not the best person to follow. It's kind of just a diary at this point, but I do post all my articles there. I also have a website that's just myname.com, and that's, you know, just little essays and scraps. That's where the Buddha essay is. And I guess I'll probably pin that to my profile now. But, you know, that's where I post, like, really bad fiction that I write or these dumb essays that I don't think are going to be worthy of getting published anywhere. So they just throw them on there. But you could find some gems in there. So that's where you could find me. Thank you for having me.
Yeah,
it's been fantastic.
Hope to have you on again. And, we'll talk to you soon. Well, that's a wrap on today's show. Once again, a reminder to go to patreon.com/thepopecast if you're a listener for free and you'd like to get that extra 5-10 minutes of bonus content. Also, for that matter, access to all of our other previous interviews. We ask what each guest, I'm not going to tell you, we ask a bonus question of each guest on whenever we have somebody on the show. So patreon.com/thepopecast if you'd like to get that and also support our work. Popes.substack.com is our newsletter. And then if you like and you haven't yet, but you've been a longtime listener to the show or even a new listener and it's made an impact, please consider rating and reviewing the Popecast over at iTunes and Spotify. We even like to read those out on the show and give you a little shout out just as a bit of thanks. But as we sign off today, always remember these are indeed strange times we live in, but they are no stranger than in ages past. Until next time.